Lecture 3, Law, Nature, Natural Law.
Over the centuries, philosophers have found that real honest disagreement in matters of morality or in any matters of philosophy requires that one have honesty of understanding what the other was saying. One can disagree about something by showing that you disliked the argument, found it somehow invalid, or you can challenge the truth of a particular premise that an argument has used. To establish the truth of those premises requires, at the very start, that there be clear definitions. So what I'd like to attempt here in this particular part of our course is a little bit of background in philosophy about definitions in general, and then I'd like to reflect on the efforts to define law and to define nature, in particular human nature, in ways that will be acceptable. To do this, I'll be making use throughout, especially of the ideas of Thomas Aquinas. For his particular clarity at coming up with some of these definitions has been crucial to the project since that time. First, however, a matter of defining definition itself. Aristotle, in some of his logical works, took it upon himself to try to offer us a definition of definition, and he does so in terms of genus and specific difference. And this has proven a strategy beneficial time and again. That is, to define something, what you do is you look for the larger group, the genus to which it belongs, and then you try to figure out which slice of the pie it is. You try to figure out the specific difference that makes everything within that subgroup united as a group, as a natural kind, because every member of that kind possesses the property, however much or however little, every member has that property which the rest of the larger group lacks. As such, it's an effort to get to objectivity in our definitions, and it follows the lead of the patron saint of philosophy, Socrates, who spent his time wandering around Athens trying to define things like virtue and justice, never quite willing to give a definition, but trying to elicit it from those with whom he was discussing in order to determine and have everyone assent to this particular approach, the larger group. When he, for instance, was trying to define virtue, he asked whether virtue is knowledge. And then, in the course of his conversation, he would bring the listeners to see that virtue isn't quite identical with knowledge, but that virtue always requires that we have a certain knowledge, a knowledge of a certain kind. And he gained the assent of those with whom he discussed by using this particular method. There are other strategies for definition. Let me consider two of them with you. One can define something in terms of its structure, or one can define it in terms of its function, its use. If one is focusing in on structure, then what one will be doing is looking at the parts and looking at the whole, trying to see that if we're defining a human being, for instance, we've got a whole, an organic unity, and we could define a human being structurally by noticing how the parts of that whole fit together. Equally, we can talk about definition in terms of function, that is, looking for what something can do. If I were to take, for instance, a piece of modern technology, something like a microphone, I could analyze it in terms of its structure by dealing with the separate parts that are involved and are put together in a certain way, but equally I can define a microphone in terms of the function that it has and realize that something that can look considerably different, where the parts are arranged in a different way, could still function in the same way and therefore still be a microphone. Our considerations, then, are to try to get objectivity, to try to see the larger group and the specific difference, sometimes focusing in on the parts in relation to the whole, sometimes considering not that, but considering the use that a thing has, the function that it has. In either procedure, whether using function or whether using structure, there is the possibility of using it well or the possibility of using it poorly. I could, for instance, use a microphone to try to hammer in a nail, but it wouldn't do a very good job at it. It would be very poor at that function. I can, on the other hand, use something that is a hammer to pound in those nails, and the structure of the pieces serve the function very well. Let me turn to the ethical application of these things. When we're trying to define human being, we face the efforts of looking for the larger group to which all human beings belong, and looking for that specific difference which is true of each one of us, and one can emphasize structural features, or one can emphasize functions. In the effort to make some of those definitions, some of the definitions that will turn out to be very, very useful. Aristotle, for instance, proposes defining the human person as a rational animal. One can see that he's got the larger group, the animals to which we all belong. He could have, I think, chosen mammals, or he could have chosen primates, but for reasons of his own, he wants to stress our animal character, the fact that we have a body, and that the body is alive for a certain number of years, and that we need to do various things in order to keep that body alive. But he also focuses on the specific difference, our rationality, taking that term rationality in a very inclusive sense, to talk about practical rationality, knowing how to do things, as well as more theoretical rationality, knowing how and being able to explain in so many words. But the efforts to define human being have not always used Aristotle's rational animal. Frequently enough, a group has wanted to define a certain other group out of consideration and out of the protections that normally going along with being a human person. One can think, for instance, about those Nuremberg trials that we gave as an example earlier on in the course. And in the Nazi system, Jews and Gypsies and other groups which the Nazis did not like were arbitrarily defined out of the race of human persons. They were defined out of the human race. You can usually spot those things because of the semantic gymnastics that are involved. And so that when the Nazis were trying to do this in the course of their own philosophizing and in the course of their own legislation, they frequently used terms that were things like parasite upon the body of Europe, or disease, in order to try to give the impression that this was something that belonged in a different genus. It belonged in the realm of medicine and of illness. And hence, if it's something of a different type, a parasite or an illness, it is most appropriate to remove, to kill, to exterminate that thing. We find that, I think, morally repugnant. And yet, when we're honest, we realize that people do this, and sometimes there can be a cultural blindness in the use of definitions. One finds, for instance, in the slaveholding that was at issue in the civil rights movement that we were discussing when we brought up Martin Luther King, that slave owners tended to regard those whom they held in bondage as pieces of property or chattel. And even our Constitution reflects this in the way that slaves were counted for the purpose of representation, but not counted when it came to matters of human rights. One sees this in the present day, for instance. There have been questions that I've noticed very recently in the paper about certain practices of the Chinese government in which they are willing to sell the organs of criminals who are executed, thereby treating those individuals as disposable property rather than as having certain intrinsic rights. I mention these examples not to try to cast blame on anyone too quickly, but simply to suggest a lot depends on our definitions. And the definitions have to be objective. They have to be done in the calm of our living rooms or our cars when we have time to listen to tapes by the teaching company before we need to act. Because if we try to generate definitions at the time when we're under enormous pressure to act, the temptation will be to generate a definition that serves our purpose, rather than a definition that offers truth because grounded upon the nature of the being. Let's turn now to the two items that are so crucial to our consideration here, namely the topics of law and of nature, specifically human nature, and to think about the efforts to define those terms. In the effort to define law, I'd like to refer us again to the works of Thomas Aquinas, whom I've indicated will be the centerpiece for my thinking in this course, though we'll be studying him in greater detail in Lecture 12 when he comes up in the historical period. I'd like to borrow just one aspect of his theory today because of the clarity he reaches on the topic of the definition of law. First, let me read to you his definition. It occurs in the Treatise on Law within the Summa of Theology. He says, law, any kind of law, is an ordering of reason promulgated by the person in charge of the community for the common good. Now, in that definition, we are to hear four important components. First, that law is an ordering of reason. The alternative would say that law is an ordering of will, that law is an ordering of power, that law is only law because there's somebody with sufficient strength, or someone with sufficient desire, or someone with sufficient will who has said so. Granting, some things are law only because there is power. Granted, some things are law only because the will of the ruler has said so. For Aquinas, and I think for any reasonable person, we would say that must be questioned. Law can't be its own source of justification in terms of power. Rather, law needs somehow to reflect reason. And hence, Aquinas would insist that all law, that any law that we might want to put to the test, has to meet the standard of being reasonable, or else it's bad law, and it might be sufficiently bad as to be something which ought to be ignored. Second part of the definition, it has to be promulgated. By that he means it has to be publicly disclosed. One can't be expected to abide by a law that one didn't know was the law. Granting when one's driving through a small town, one might not notice the speed limits that have been posted, but they had better be posted. And if they haven't been posted, one can't be held accountable for having gone too fast. If one didn't notice them, then it's the driver's problem. The law must somehow be promulgated. Third, it has to be promulgated by the person in charge of the community. That is, there's a recognition here that there are authorities, and that authority, at least in principle, is legitimate, and that authority in principle is different than power. Now, this is worth reflecting on for just a minute. Namely, some people, I think, are inclined to coalesce authority and power, and to insist that authority is nothing other than its power. But I don't think, honestly, that any of us could live with that, and I think we need to make a distinction between authority and power. I'd like to define authority in this way, that authority is that person or that office who is witnessing to some truth that is earlier or prior or higher than the authority himself, and then using power to do that witness. Some examples. I think that a policeman is an authority, but that a policeman is an authority not because of the power that he packs in his pistol. Rather, the pistol, or any kind of power that the policeman has, will be a kind of power that will maybe be used to quell those who are resistant. And yet, any police officer knows that that's the last resort, that there's a moral suasion, that there's a way in which that policeman is witnessing to the truths of the community about the order of that community, asking people to be peaceable, asking people not to rob one another or to beat one another, but rather to settle their differences amicably, and that he will follow the perspective of the city council or the authority higher than himself, which has decided upon the policies the policeman uses. Take a different instance. How about a third-grade teacher teaching fractions? Admittedly, we've got a lot of power here, and the teacher is going to put the class through some exercises with respect to, we're going to practice fractions now, and now we're going to practice spelling. But the teacher isn't the source of the truths to which the teacher is witnessing. One-third plus one-half does not equal one-fifth, even though 3 plus 2 is 5. The teacher is not making up the truth as she goes, but rather there's a strong sense that there are truths to which the teacher is witnessing as an authority. If any of you have ever been parents, you realize that you are a moral authority there too, and you hope to be a reasonable authority, and yet you may not in every single instance be able to explain all of the reasons that you have for making the decisions that you do. What time a child should come in when that child is now a teenager and wants to stay out late at night will be decisions that an authority needs to make. Progressively, they have to respect the freedom of the teenager. And yet, there is an authority that needs to be asserted here. Someone who is not making the authority felt well enough will leave the child feeling that someone doesn't care. On the other hand, someone who's too stringent will be instead almost oppressive in the way in which the authority is making its will known. In general, then, an authority refers to the person or the office which is charged with maintaining this witness and making various decisions, using that power, and this will be crucial to the notion of a law. The fourth part of the definition is for the common good. Namely, that if a law is designed simply to favor the self-interest of the ruler, or the self-interest of those whom the ruler likes, the law quickly comes into contempt. Somehow the law has to look out for the common good, difficult as that will be sometimes to establish. Now, for Thomas Aquinas, and for the natural law tradition, this definition of law will hold for all the instances of law that we find, including natural law. Granted, this is controversial. Granted, some people will object to it. There will be people who hold a voluntarist notion of law, who insist that law is what it is simply because of the will of the ruler, because of the power of those who put the law down on paper or make it prominent in a given community. And there will be some who will insist we have to do it because it is impossible for us ever to know the natures of things in matters of morality. This is a topic we'll have to consider. So I'm noting that there are objections, and yet what I'd like to emphasize today is that we have at least a reasonable view of the definition of law when we emphasize its intellectual or reasonable component. Let's use that definition and divide. Let's make a certain typology of the kind of laws. Thomas Aquinas urges that there are four such kinds of law. The highest kind of law that he envisions is what he calls eternal law. This is the law that God, in his own providential care of the universe, has made when God devised and created the natures of each of the particular objects that are in the world. He's devised by his intelligence a nature for them by which most of them operate all the time. This would be to say that there is a natural law for horses by which horses do horsey things, and a natural law for cats by which they do the things for which felines are known. There's a natural law for electrons in that they very steadily refute the attraction of other electrons and instead find themselves attracted to protons. There's a sense of natural law in which all of nature is covered by the way in which things have their very being. For human beings, however, it will be more complicated, precisely because our human nature is a personal nature. Nonetheless, this first type of law, according to Aquinas, is the law that God has designed by his providence, by which each nature very regularly acts toward the end for which is natural to it. A second type of law is called divine law. We saw this a couple of lectures ago when we were talking about divine command theory. For Aquinas, divine law refers to those commands, those directives, those laws which God has explicitly and in so many words declared. Things like the Decalogue that occurs in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, things like the two commandments that Jesus enunciates, things like the Quran, which is an effort to say, here is a divine revelation about how we must act. Aquinas reflects on why God would make both an eternal law and a divine law, and he takes note of the fact that it was so wise of God to explicitly state what the laws are with respect to humankind, because not everybody will have time to reflect upon what God's plan is, nor will everybody have the same intelligence by which to figure it out. And sometimes, even when we can intuit what that law is, even when we feel a spontaneous inclination toward the end for which our nature has been created, nonetheless, we can be uncertain, and we will be aided by the added certainty of God having said so in so many words. A third kind of law that Aquinas enunciates, and one that is so prominent in what we are talking about in this course, is natural law. Aquinas envisions natural law as our human participation in God's providential ordering of the universe. Namely, we are more like God than any other creature, precisely by having an intellect and by having a will. Our rationality, as is manifested in our power to know things and in our power to choose things, is much more similar to God than any of the other creatures that God has ever created. We're able to look ahead. We're able to understand both what our nature, what our families, what our communities need, and we're able to see what sort of things would frustrate those natural ends, what sort of things would destroy or make it very hard for us to enjoy the happiness for which we seem to be designed. Hence, natural law, for Thomas, refers to the power of our reason to reflect upon our nature so as to determine what it is that is morally required. It's not that natural law is written anywhere in a book that we can look it up. It is rather something that is written upon our very being, written in the heart. And if we look conscientiously enough at what is written on our heart, if we look at that to which all human beings are inclined, and if we start sorting out those things which are just self-interested from that which is needed by everybody in order to be a human being, full and mature and flourishing, he thinks we'll be able to see what some of these natural law obligations and natural rights are. Finally, the fourth category is human law or positive law. I mean not positive in the sense of positive versus negative, but positive in the sense of laid down or posited by a human authority. Human law also must meet this standard of being an ordinance of reason, promulgated by the person in charge of the community for the common good. There will be lots of things which the natural law doesn't determine. Should we drive, for instance, on the right side of the road or on the left? Natural law doesn't require that it be one rather than the other. Natural law simply requires that the person in charge of the community decide, because high-speed automobile traffic is not going to work well if we each choose. Rather, there's a natural law obligation that someone decide the question, which is entirely neutral in terms of its determination, and then that the rest of us respect it, like it or not, in order for the common good of human safety as well as efficiency in travel and transportation be affected. The only important obligation that natural law holds out for positive law or human law is that human law should never violate that natural law. And we saw that, for instance, in the case of Antigone or in the case of Martin Luther King or in the case of those Nuremberg trials. We found some egregious instances when positive law seemed to violate natural law obligations. Question then comes, should we try to work with the legislature to overturn the bad legislation? Should we simply disobey and in civil disobedience accept the consequences? Should a court take it in hand and try to overturn this by judicial review? These are great questions. For the remainder of this lecture, I'd like to turn our attention to the questions about the definition of nature, just as we have now wrestled with questions about the definition of law. We've been, so far, practicing a kind of top-down philosophy by looking at the criteria that any ethics will have to meet if it's going to be reasonable, namely, to be objective and to be universal and to be intelligible. But in the effort to define human nature, frankly, we can't start at the top. We have to start at the bottom and work our way up. This is the procedure that Aquinas recommends, following the philosopher to whom he is most indebted, namely Aristotle. What Aristotle recommended with respect to the definition of the nature of anything is that we undertake two processes, observation and reflection. In short, defining the nature of anything will require that we get lots and lots and lots of examples and that we compare the things that we have observed to try to see what it is that is really common, and on the other hand, what is merely idiosyncratic or typical of just this subgroup or that subgroup. Hence, we're working from the bottom very inductively by trying to do lots of observation and then lots of reflection upon which we make our abstractions. It will be a matter of coming to know the types of things on the basis of their structures and on the basis of their activities and, very important for living things, on the basis of their development. Again, let's take a case other than the human case for just a minute to see the importance of this. If, for instance, you see a caterpillar, and then you see a cocoon, and then you see a butterfly, to see them independently would lead one to think that we had three very different kinds of things. And yet we know that when we've observed long enough, that we've actually got one and the same nature. We can now examine its DNA structure at the molecular level, but we can also see, simply by observing it over the course of time, that we have a common nature there which is developing and maturing and promoting the good of the whole species by its own individual participation in the maturation activities of that particular species. So, too, with respect to humankind. Our observation of it will show us both the mature instances as well as the stages of gestation. And on this point, it is so important to reflect for just a few minutes about how we take this term natural. Namely, the term natural, when we're using it in ethics and defining human nature so carefully so as to make statements about what is natural in the moral sense and what is in some way or other unnatural, always has reference to the normal case as its starting point. We call it in philosophy the privilege of the normal case. That when we're trying to look at what is typical of a human being vis-a-vis other species, we look at the normal, mature, healthy adult. And we look at the skills and the abilities. And then, after looking at the things, the operations we see a person do, we look at the bodily structure which makes those activities and those operations possible. And then we look to the powers that are present that make those activities possible. And finally, we articulate a definition of the thing's nature, having worked inductively from activities to structures to powers, back to that collection of traits and powers that are typical of the human being. But we admit we are using the normal, healthy, privileged adult as our privileged case. My brother is a pathologist, a veterinary pathologist, and he loves telling the story about how veterinary pathologists learn their art. What they often do is take a nice, healthy instance of the animal in question, and then you trace disease on the basis of health. You never trace health on the basis of disease. You start with the healthy individual, and then you see what the various kinds of sickness are. Now, this said, we need to make another important point about not using those healthy, normal, mature adult functions, not using them as demarcation principles for excluding instances of the species from the species. If, for instance, one is dealing with the unborn, or dealing with very young children, or dealing with teenagers, or dealing with the very old who have lost the use of some of their functions. If one were taking the healthy, normal adult case, one would say that the unborn, or that the very, very young, or the senile and the decrepit, the person with Alzheimer's, or the person who's laying in a persistent vegetative state, if one were trying to use a definition that were done strictly in terms of function, these people would be cut off from our consideration. They would either have ceased to have the structures or the functions that we're so interested in, or they would have not yet seen these structures and functions develop into the maturity that we find in the privileged case. Very important, therefore, to be clear on how we define in terms of structure or how we define in terms of function, because many a person in the modern philosophical community has attempted to give a definition of the human person strictly in terms of the functioning of rationality, and have been quick to be willing to have physician-assisted suicide, various forms of euthanasia, cutting off those who were at the end of life, or various forms of abortion or infanticide near the beginning, I think because their definitions have been too narrow. Part of what we need to understand is that the species is not defined in terms of the function. Rather, species is compared with other species in terms of function, whereas membership in the species is determined largely on the basis of the origins of the individual, produced by other members of the human species, whether in the biological ways that are typical of sexual reproduction, or perhaps even done in technological manner, such as is now possible in vitro fertilization, when the gametes are made to arrange themselves and to unite in a petri dish. Our consideration here for moral purposes needs then to take careful consideration about how our definition was reached and what is contained in it. Aristotle's definition, which Aquinas supports and which I would like to discuss with you in the remaining time on this lecture, and especially in the fourth lecture that we will do in this introductory set, concerns the human being as rational animal. To take this definition is to focus on the genus, what we share with the larger group. We could have taken all beings, or all living beings, but it's useful to take all animate beings precisely because our animal selves, the various things that we need for reproduction, the things that we need for nutrition, the things that we need for our animal life, are so frequently considerations in matters of ethics. But then, also, questions of being mammals, questions of being primates. All of these are the groups to which we belong, and ultimately the specific difference, the thing that sets us apart, is our rationality. Now, Aristotle only got as far as calling us rational animals. One of the distinctions that has been made since then that has been utterly crucial has been that we are also persons. And in the next lecture, we'll consider this question of personality and how that adds to the question of rationality. Here in this lecture, we do well simply to take note of the rationality in all of its many forms, the practical rationality of knowing how to do and how to make, the theoretical rationality in terms of how to understand, and to take note that this will be an important, a crucial aspect of our personal nature, that is, beings with a responsibility that comes from having known and having chosen, having been irreplaceably unique individuals, and therefore as having a special dignity among all creatures, such that there are moral rights and moral duties.